Maniscalco v. Simon, and it's Mr. Grossman.
May it please the Court, my name is Richard Grossman. I represent plaintiff Anthony Maniscalco. This case really has two parts, and I suppose the overarching question is, was there enough evidence pointed to in the record to create a genuine issue of material fact, making summary judgment appropriate? The second question deals with the issue of vicarious liability, and I propose to take them in order. I was struck by an opinion recently written about a month ago by your colleague, Judge Wood. I try to read these things, and as it's worth emphasizing that the non-moving party in a summary judgment proceeding does not bear the burden of proving his case. Rather, he just has to point to evidence that can be put in admissible form at trial and that, if believed by the fact finder, could support judgment in his favor.
I have to say right at the outset that I think your theory is very intriguing, but I keep wondering, what's the backstory here between, you know, Mr. Maniscalco and the Gurnee police force him to believe he was framed?
Well, this is an amended complaint that we're operating off of. The first complaint, I don't know if it's even in the record, and I guess if it's not, I can't talk about it. But you asked the question, so I'll tell you that if you look at that complaint, we lay out a whole political intrigue type thing, and that really was what was going on here. But
he's coming from a political fundraiser, right?
That's right. Again, you know what? I should know this, but I don't know whether that complaint is in the record. But if it's not on the record, I'm sure that you can ignore it. But in that complaint, we allege that there is some rather significant disagreements between the present mayor and my client, and that the police chief came into his restaurant and said, well, you know, I can't protect you anymore. And then a month later, this happened. So, I mean, again, if it's DeHore's the record,
It seems to me that his theory hinges in substantial part on the notion that no physical description had been broadcast to the police officers, and yet all of them, including Officer Hellman, seemed to know it was him. But as I understand the record, all that Officer Olds testified was that he didn't remember a physical description being broadcast. And, you know, whereas the other officers saying, oh, yes, you know, it was. So, I mean,
well,
Officer Olds' lack of memory on this point wouldn't be sufficient to establish a dispute of fact, would it?
There's still a question. He says he doesn't remember that there was a description given out, and yet he can pick. I'll tell you what. My client is sitting in this courtroom. You pick out the Italian over there. I don't know. What are there, 20 people in here?
I think I know.
Okay. Well, but then again, there's 20,000 people living in Gurnee.
I'm Latvian. He's Irish.
Right.
German English.
But I'm saying it's look, the idea that someone could make a guess that out of all the people living in Gurnee, there's 20,000 people living there. They acknowledge that there's other people of Italian descent that they could pick out. And by the way,
But he was known to members of the Gurnee police force, I gather.
Not these members. So he said that he doesn't remember it. He didn't know him very well. He saw him once. So
he may be handsome enough to make that.
Well,
I see a handsome man. I see only handsome men in this courtroom.
My point is, first of all, there's three, I think, McDonald's employees, and these McDonald's employees look at a man that's not there for more than 1 minute coming through the McDonald's drive-thru and say, he's Italian. and he's in his mid-40s, well, I suppose you can look Italian, but
yeah.
I just think that's pretty thin.
Yeah. A lot of Italians look Italian, but a lot of not Italians look Italian too.
Well, I'm just suggesting that the overall impression here is that on very, very slight evidence, everybody in the world seemed to know that this was Tony Maniscalco that was being arrested. And this is a small town. The evidence was in the deposition that they could they knew each other even by their numbers. You know, this is 110. Everybody knew each other. And Officer Old says that everybody knew. Everybody. All the people that were using their dashboards. This was the fact that prevented Judge Gettleman from entering a judgment to dismiss it when they made their motion to dismiss. He said, look at this. They knew who it was before they were told. That has never been controverted. And then you have, of course, the testimony of Mr. Castro, who said that a Gurney police officer came through with his license plate on it. Well, and hand this to one of the employees. I don't know why the jury can't hear this evidence. I think the judge concluded that there was no direct or circumstantial evidence amounting to a possible conspiracy between the police and the McDonald's employees. But I just think that the record is replete with indications that there was something afoot and that other people who shouldn't have known that this was Tony Maniscalco knew that it was Tony Maniscalco. That's. I think a jury is entitled to hear that and make their own decision about it. To be cut off from going to a jury with it, I think, is inappropriate.
Well, if there's an independent basis for probable cause, though, why would the suspicious and strange surrounding circumstances matter?
Well, I point out that your colleague, Judge Posner, says that they don't even have to investigate the claim of a citizen. They can make an arrest on probable cause just on the citizen's complaint unless they know something's fishy. That's what he says in Gazelle.
Well, he knows more about fishing than I do. So.
Sorry?
I said he knows more about fishing than I
do. Well, I think I have to take it seriously. I mean, it's an opinion, and he says, you know, if you have reason to know. In other words, this case is about the fact that the police had reason to know that there was something strange here, and that's suggested anyway, and by circumstantial evidence, by the fact that if you were arrested leaving this courtroom today, and it was proven that there was your license plate in a police officer's pocket, you're going to tell me that that's not suspicious to you? That doesn't create some kind of suspicion that something fishy is going on? I suggest that the opposite. I think my time is up.
Save it.
I would like to
address you've got it.
Yeah.
Ms. Bednarik, you're going to be taking 6 minutes. I'm sorry, 5 minutes.
And I'm. My name is Lucy Bednarik. May it please the court. I'm representing the Gurney police officers Jay Simon and Jeffrey Hoffman. Just to clarify one thing, I think Your Honor inquired about. At Plaintiff's deposition, he did testify that on page 199 of his deposition, he testified that he believed that the conspiracy was created, that the police had it out for him so that he couldn't run for political office in the future. And he had run in the past, according to his deposition, for a trustee and a mayor position, and he had lost both times, which is one of the reasons also that it's reasonable that the Gurney police knew who he was. He had obviously run for office in a small community. He owned a small business in the community, and he was a well-known figure in the community. Plaintiff's only claim on appeal here is conspiracy, that the Gurney officers conspired to have him arrested that night. But in order to prove conspiracy, he had to prove that a constitutional right was violated. And the district court properly found that the uncontroverted evidence showed that the Gurney officers had probable cause to arrest him for both disorderly conduct and for driving under the influence. And
what are we to make of the fact that Officer Hauptman said he surmised that the suspect was Mr. Maniscalco, based in part on the address corresponding to the automobile that the suspect was driving, when that automobile belonged to his girlfriend, you know, not to him? Just would that call into question Officer Hauptman's credibility, do you think?
I don't believe so. He testified that he knew approximately where Mr. Maniscalco resided, and the address that was registered on the vehicle was approximately near that. But he also added that he knew of Mr. Maniscalco before the stop. He knew his physical description, his reputation in the community, his personality. And from conversations from other police officers, he testified that he even knew about his short temper. And so all of those things, based on the fact that he had several run-ins with the police in the past, the police department as a whole knew who he was, that I don't think it's unreasonable at all for Officer Hauptman to guess.
What kind of run-ins?
There was a few years prior to this incident, I believe there was an incident where Officer Simon actually had to respond to an incident at his restaurant. I can't recall the exact details of the incident at this time, but there had been several other incidents involving Gurney police.
How long before this incident had he been a candidate for political office?
I believe he ran for mayor a year before. I could be mistaken, but I know it was within the 5 years prior to this incident.
And he had also run for the
trustee.
City council?
I'm
for,
sorry?
For what? For trustee. For
yes.
City council?
Correct.
On issues having to do with the police department?
I don't believe so. That's not in the record. I don't know. the district court found that there was probable cause to arrest him takes this conspiracy claim out of the equation, because if his constitutional rights were not violated, there could not have been a conspiracy to do so. And if you look at the underlying facts of the disorderly conduct charge, it's pretty clear that even based on Mr. Maniscalco's own testimony, that he swore at the employees, he was disruptive, he was loud, he was yelling, that there was a basis based on not on his own testimony, but on the testimony from the McDonald's employees themselves, that there was a basis for a disorderly conduct charge. And what's interesting here is that Mr. Maniscalco and his attorney have not contested at all in this appeal that there was no basis for probable cause for his DUI charge. He didn't address that at all in either his opening brief or his reply brief. And it's pretty clear that the basis for the DUI charge was Officer Simon's, the results of Officer Simon's field sobriety tests, as well as his own observations, nothing that had to do with the McDonald's employees. And I think that is a significant point here. But what is also significant is that there's nothing connecting the two officers to this piece of paper incident at the McDonald's. And so for those reasons, I ask that this court affirm the judgment in this matter.
Thank you. Mr. Dombrowski. And, you also have 5 minutes.
Yes, thank you.
Because 5 and 5 equals 10.
Jerry Dombrowski on behalf of McDonald's Restaurants of Illinois. May it please the court. Thank you for this time. Our issues are separate, but they are similar. The similarities are between our position and Gurney's position is, was there probable cause to arrest Mr. Maniscalco? The answer is yes. I just wanted to bring the court back to the sworn testimony of Officer Hauptman, Mr. Guzman employee, and Ms. Escobar employee. Officer Hauptmann did interview, after the 911 call, Mr. Guzman and Ms. Escobar. They both consistently told the officer that they believed that Mr. Maniscalco not only was disorderly and belligerent, but that, according to Mr. Guzman's testimony, that he believed Mr. Maniscalco was intoxicated. Mr. Guzman also stated to the officer and testified that Mr. Maniscalco grabbed him at the first window. Ms. Escobar also testified, and her statement was taken at the restaurant when all this was going on, just after Mr. Maniscalco left, that she felt that Mr. Maniscalco was going to come through that second window where you give the customer food. So that information that Officer Hauptmann had, and at least in part relate to Officer Olds and then to Officer Simon at the scene, is plenty information that the Gurnee police could count on as reliable to arrest Mr. Maniscalco. Now, if this court believes that somehow there was fishiness going on, there was some type of concerted agreement between the Gurnee officers and that unknown Gurnee officer, then we go to Iskander and his progeny, and I think that is good law as we stand here today, and it should not be interrupted. And I would point to the court, Iskander did cite Monell. There's no respondeat superior liability in 1983 cases corporate defendants. But if the court wants to reconsider Iskander, I'm urging the court not to, of course, because it's perfectly fine law, and the Seventh Circuit has passed on it again in 2010. If we go one step beyond, if this court said states, well, we think there's some evidence of a civil conspiracy, which is an intentional tort, and we want to reconsider Iskander, if we go to the law that is cited by Mr. Grossman in his reply brief, the Illinois Supreme Court case, it's actually a Civil War case, an 1862 case, Oxford versus Peter, which principles, even if we make that vicarious liability analysis, the master-servant, principal-agent, employer, employee analysis, Mr. Maniscalco's case still fails as it relates to McDonald's restaurants of Illinois. In that case, it's a three-page Illinois Supreme Court case where the master farmer sends out the boy servant to chase away one cow. He ends up chasing away several other cows that are off the property of the master. One of those cows dies. The court actually decided in favor of the defendant on that case and said, well, he sent his servant, the boy, out to just chase away one cow. He went beyond that. So if Mr. Maniscalco is stating, and Mr. Grossman stating, well, let's do this vicarious liability analysis and ignore Iskander in all the cases after Iskander, the plaintiff still loses as to McDonald's, because if we take Mr. Maniscalco's argument and state, well, yes, there was a conspiracy, yes, they had it out for Mr. Maniscalco, these employees, Mr. Guzman and Ms. Escobar, then they clearly are acting outside the scope of their employment, and McDonald's would not be held responsible for that activity.
Isn't that usually a jury question?
No, I don't think in some cases it is, in some cases it's not. I don't think here with the testimony it would be a jury question, given that if the master's business, as the Oxford case talked about, is selling hamburgers, that's what the master's business is here, and that doesn't promote the business if you set up a patron who's willing to pay. So, and again, I just wanted to correct something in the plaintiff, the appellant's reply brief and also the initial brief. They stated that Mr. Fidel Castro's testimony regarding the slipping of the digits, the four digits, was uncontroverted. It is completely controverted, not only by Mr. Guzman, but it's also controverted the conspiracy itself by every defense witness who testified, and I specifically asked them.
Except at this juncture, we have to assume that Fidel Castro was telling the truth.
You do, Your Honor, but if I may just answer this last question, his testimony is entirely implausible, and I think I pointed that out in my brief. It simply does not make sense. So I think testimony that's implausible and doesn't make sense, I don't think the panel has to consider that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Grossman, how much time? Okay.
I asked for two.
First, Ms. Bednarik says that we don't talk about the DUI. The reason I don't talk about it, right, he got arrested for disorderly conduct. It was only after they got him to the police station, and then they realized that they didn't have a terrific disorderly conduct case, that they then, we allege, you know, they made the DUI. I mean, there was disputes about whether he was stumbling or whatever, talking. And he, of course, says that he wasn't, and they say that he was. And as Judge Sykes points out, that the fact is that's all the more reason why there should be a hearing on this.
They didn't do the field sobriety test at the scene, did they?
I don't believe they did. I think they did it at the station. I think.
And is it normal police practice to do the field sobriety test at the scene?
I would think so, but I don't know.
We don't know.
Secondly, I just have a minute to respond to this issue, which is
that's
quite
why they're called field sobriety tests.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
Because they're done in the field.
Okay, that's a good point. The vicarious liability issue. No one has suggested that the analysis that I've engaged in is wrong. That you only apply defenses and immunities that were present at the time of the passage of the Act. There's no question but that vicarious liability was a feature, a regular feature, today, still,
it's
uniform.
It's a theory of liability. It's not a defense or immunity. So that line of cases that you're referring to is not applicable here.
Go ahead. Go ahead, finish.
Do you get what I'm driving at here?
Well,
I mean, maybe we look to whether it was a viable theory of liability at the time, but the particular.
But I wasn't. But we weren't even allowed to present that theory. So that's okay. I ask that you reverse the decision.
Thank you. Case is taken under advisement.